Thank you very much for those. Oops, I should switch this on. It doesn't seem to want to go on. Is that okay? Thank you, Tom, for those very kind words. And thank you, Mona, for inviting me for the Institute of Humanities and the university. This is my first visit to Nashville. And my subject is going to be about the post-war future in Iraq and of what it is possible to make of this country and why. But before I embark on that enterprise, I'm going to speak for a while on the course of the war, since I assume that's on everyone's mind and everyone's following the news these days, and particularly of the Iraqi response to that war. And let me begin by saying that on January 10th of this year, when the president asked me how American troops would be received when they entered Iraqi cities, I replied as liberators. And I went further and said, with sweets and flowers. This reply was no different than that of other members of the Iraqi opposition when asked the same question in various contexts. And so I ask in retrospect, after 12 days after the outbreak of this war, was that a correct assessment or not? And the simple answer, as always in life, is yes and no. And I want to try and explain what I mean by that. A variety of commentators are today implying that a rising surge of Iraqi patriotism is preventing Iraqis from greeting coalition troops with open arms, as people like myself suggested they would. They are saying that the U.S. government has been misled by the Iraqi opposition. I think these commentators are misreading the Iraqi reaction of the first 10 days of this war, a reaction, incidentally, that is already beginning to change, judging by news reports of the last couple of days and especially today. What has prevented Iraqis from rising and taking over the streets of Iraqi cities in the south are two very important things. First, a legacy of mistrust about American intentions originating in the catastrophe that befell the people of the South when they did in fact rise up after the last Gulf War of 1991 and were crushed. This legacy the coalition forces have so far not succeeded in dispelling. And this legacy I too probably underestimated. But the second factor is fear of the murderous thugs, otherwise known as Fidayeen Saddam, that you're probably reading about these days, whose numbers and distribution in the cities I also perhaps underestimated. Let me tell you a thing or two about Fidayeen Saddam. These are the men who are conducting the pinprick attacks on coalition forces that we see or that we saw highlighted in the media until recently, and that they are very wrongly referred to occasionally by some reporters as some form of Iraqi resistance to the American forces. The Fidayeen are nothing of the sort. It is important to remember that they are a force created after 1991, after the crushing of the uprising, and they were created with the very specific intention of ensuring that an uprising like that which followed the last Gulf War never happens again. Recruited as young teenagers, these men were trained in the notorious facility of Salman Park, just outside Baghdad. Their training involves keeping them in total isolation from their hometowns, their families, their regions, to which, incidentally, they are never assigned when finally the process of training is over. And they are trained in the most brutal and savage ways of forcing a population into acquiescence. So how to break this vicious cycle of fear and mistrust? One must remember, Iraqis inside Iraq, in the cities of the south that are being liberated as the coalition forces get stronger and stronger there, do not get CNN and other channels of media, of the Western media. They have not heard, as we have, constant iterations of how Saddam's demise is imminent, how important it is to this administration that the regime be replaced entirely, how resolute is the president on the matter of terminating this regime as a whole. More importantly, they have not seen it take place on the ground as they did in 1991 when they revolted after 6 weeks of not seeing Saddam's image on the television screens and hearing him and his henchmen on their media. Coalition forces so far have been content to position themselves outside Iraqi cities in southern Iraq, that is until very recently again, and only after incessant urgings from members of the Iraqi opposition have they finally begun to disrupt Iraqi TV, Saddam's principal tool of not losing face in Iraq. And above all, coalition forces have not allowed, until very recently again, Iraqis to go in and organize the population, which they are willing and champing at the bit to do. Iraqis outside at the moment, outside the south, from the south. In Basra, this has meant the tanks sitting on the outskirts of a very porous city whose main routes in and out of the city have not even been fully cut off. Sporadic and faint-hearted British fire was not enough to prevent Saddam's brown shirts from quelling the beginnings of a popular uprising in Nasiriyah. And until the day before yesterday, Iraqi TV was still on the air everywhere. Hanging over the head of every Iraqi, like a sword of Damocles, is this haunting memory of March 1991, when the uprising of the people of southern Iraq was mercilessly suppressed, and in a particularly brutal way in the southern city of Basra. If Saddam came back from the grave after 1991, Iraqis are asking themselves, or thinking to themselves, what guarantees do they have that he will not do so now? Phone calls the opposition has received some 4 days ago from sources in southern Iraq confirm this sense of ambiguity, hesitation on the part of ordinary people. Let me give you an example. A group of rebels in the city of Nasiriyah called the leadership of the Iraqi opposition in the north 4 days ago, as I said. They wanted to know what to do with a number of abandoned military vehicles, Iraqi army vehicles, which included a tank, an armored personnel carrier, and other cars, vehicles. They asked, should we sequester these and turn them against the regime? The answer from that leadership was no, because if you do so, you will almost certainly be shot at by coalition forces. For the Iraqi opposition has not yet been given the special kind of devices needed to distinguish friend from foe. But as I said, in the last few days, those are being readily supplied. That was the state of coordination that existed between the opposition and the coalition forces until less than 5 days ago. And as I said, it's beginning to change, thank God. It's important to understand just how difficult it is for an American or coalition soldier to quell the perfectly legitimate fears of ordinary people living in cities like Basra or tomorrow in Baghdad. Only other Iraqis, attentive to the nuances of their own society and culture, can do this. Communicating with Iraqis about such things simply cannot be written on a 3-by-5-inch rules of engagement card. Again, only Iraqis can get this, other Iraqis can get messages distributed through local social networks, and only they can reassure their fellow citizens that they are truly about to be liberated this time around, not occupied, or worse, betrayed, and even perhaps inadvertently killed. Saddam's image and that of his henchmen have been visible all throughout the campaigns in the south and the bombing of Baghdad. And it's important to understand that Saddam rules through his face, through his ubiquitous presence in day-to-day life. That is what his millions of larger-than-life wall posters are all about. Every day that image is aired reinforces an aura of invincibility. Despite the on-camera speculation of the Western media, not a single Iraqi believes him to be dead. Iraqi state TV must, therefore, I say to you, be put out of commission permanently for his authority to be broken inside the country. So what if it has to be rebuilt after the war, as one American official pointed out to me? Money pinching at the tactical level will lead to disaster at a strategic level. But eliminating his image is not enough. An alternative image must be projected, and by Iraqis, not Americans. The Iraqi opposition should have been given the equipment it needed inside Iraq to do those kinds of things, television, radio equipment. It should have been given that equipment months ago. And if not months ago, then now. And it, even as I talk, people are now running and scrambling to do it at this late stage. Let us hope it is not too late. My overall point, is that the coalition needs the Iraqi opposition. Iraqis who can sneak into cities and help organize other Iraqis, men from the same families and social networks who know how to communicate with their entrapped brethren, who can tell them why Saddam this time is truly finished, and who are able to root out his cronies and distinguish strangers from ordinary citizens of a particular town or village when these people try to melt away into the civilian population. One cannot liberate a people, much less lay the ground for the emergence of a democracy, without empowering the people being liberated. Liberation, the key word of this war, means empowerment. And democracy, of course, is an even higher level of empowerment. It is 1,000 times easier for an Iraqi soldier to join his fellow Iraqis in rebellion than it is to surrender his arms in humiliation to a foreigner who is unable even to communicate with him and whom he mistrusts because of what happened 10 years ago. Did not Europe need its World War II resistance to Nazi occupation to help, partially at least, redeem a country like France's sense of self-respect and honor? Iraq today is no different than occupied Europe yesterday. Moreover, it's not necessary for coalition soldiers to die in street-to-street fighting inside Iraq. On the other hand, I submit, it is both morally right and politically liberating for Iraqis to do so. And there are very large numbers of people prepared and positively willing to die doing this. Such participation will add real legitimacy and therefore stability to a future Iraqi interim authority, which otherwise, no matter how you look at it, has to be picked and chosen by American officials and will lack, therefore, the kind of legitimacy needed to deal with the difficult tasks ahead. Now, I spoke about laying the grounds in Iraq for the emergence of a democracy. Those are big words. What might one mean by that? And I intend in the rest of my remarks to paint a picture of what a future Iraq post-Saddam Hussein might look like. Now, a note of caution here. While the ideas I am dealing with take as their starting point Iraqi realities, they are not self-evident. By this I mean they do not take as their point of departure the lowest common denominator of Iraqi politics or Arab politics or Middle Eastern politics as a whole. They are feasible ideas, but their feasibility requires leadership, imaginative leadership, imaginative Iraqi leadership, and imaginative American leadership. The kind of leadership that has a long-term political vision, not only of Iraq, but of the whole Middle East. Some parts of this American administration do have such a vision, but other parts are actively hostile to it. Most importantly, from my point of view, or point of view of people like me, is the fact that the president has clearly declared his intentions in this respect. He wants to be associated with such a major transformation of American policy in the Middle East. So, assuming that this president's view on this matter continues to hold sway, and that he sticks to the kind of resolve he displayed in his February 27th speech at the American Enterprise Institute, I want to suggest that the removal of the regime of Saddam Hussein presents the United States and the whole Middle East, in fact, with a historic opportunity that is about as large as anything that has happened in the Middle East since the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the entry of British troops into Iraq in 1917. Iraq is not Afghanistan. It is rich enough and developed enough and has the human resources and the financial resources to become as great a force for democracy and economic reconstruction in the Arab and Muslim world as it has been a force for autocracy and destruction in the past. But for the rest of the world to be able to see the challenge in this way, it is necessary to change the terms of the debate over this war in Iraq. And that has not yet happened. Certainly, it has not happened in the media and vis-a-vis European and Arab, and by that I mean Arab but non-Iraqi, perceptions of what this war is about. Instead, much of the debate over Iraq has been, I submit to you, a selfish one, centered on the threats to the West and its friends on the one hand, and on the moral issues arising from American hegemony on the other. It has been all about us in the West and not about those who have had to live inside the grip of one of the most brutal dictatorships of modern times. I should say here that it has been even more selfish among non-Iraqi Arabs, if there can be said to have been any kind of a debate at all on the possibility that this war may actually end up being a force for good in the Middle East, as opposed to the unmitigated disaster that most or almost all non-Iraqi Arabs seem to think it will be. The spectrum of what it is possible to talk about in Arab politics these days runs from Palestine at one end to Palestine at the other, with no room for the plight of the people of Iraq. This is a sad reflection on the state of Arab politics, and it is in large part an explanation for why there has arisen a great big divide between Arab and European perceptions of this war versus American and versus Iraqi and American ones. There is, I submit, and I shall try to lay out a bit now, a great deal more at stake here than the elimination of weapons of mass destruction and the removal of Saddam Hussein as an individual or even as a group of individuals, important and real as these are as considerations. And it is in that spirit of interesting you in what is possible in Iraq that I would now like to share with you the kind of thinking that is going on in some Iraqi circles with which I happen to be involved and which are working closely, intimately, in fact, with various agencies of the government of the United States that support this project. So let me begin first with an issue that for historical reasons has assumed an inordinately large role inside the Iraqi opposition. And that is the idea that the new Iraqi state that should emerge out of the ashes of this war should in some way or another be federal in structure. The origins of this idea began in 1992 when the Kurdish parliament voted in favor for it. A few months later, the Iraqi National Congress, the main opposition group, adopted this policy in its conference in Salah Ad-Din, northern Iraq, an event which I was privileged to attend and where I was asked to deliver a keynote speech on the subject. I came down strongly in favor of the idea of federalism as a solution to the problems of the Iraqi state. The Iraqi National Congress later reaffirmed federalism at its over and over again, and most recently at its 1999 conference in New York. And incidentally, the whole Iraqi opposition reaffirmed them in their conference in December of last year and also in the conference of Salah Ad-Din, northern Iraq, last month, which I also happened to attend. These votes are the first of their kind in the modern history of Iraq. And taken together, they break the mold of Iraqi and Arab politics. There is still no literature in Arabic or on this word, federalism, just as there is, outside the experience of the United Arab Emirates, no real Arab experience of federalism. And yet today, most Iraqi political organizations that oppose the regime in Baghdad, whether they are in the Iraqi National Congress or not, advocate one interpretation or another of this idea of federalism. In fact, no Iraqi political organization can afford not to, especially one that calls itself democratic. That is how pervasive the concept has become. I consider this an immense gain for the people of Iraq, one which should not be frittered away by the disagreements which have also quite naturally broken out over what this movable feast of a word means. Now, two features unite all definitions in play in the Iraqi political arena at the moment. And the first thing they all have in common is that the idea of federalism, whatever else it may mean, is a form of devolution of power away from the center, Baghdad, towards the provinces. And the second idea is that no future state in Iraq can be democratic if it is not at the same time federal in structure. The novelty of this of federalism is a reflection of that of the novelty of the whole phenomenon of the post-1991 Iraqi opposition, an opposition that is grounded not in issues of national liberation, quote-unquote armed struggle, and the so-called struggle against Zionism and imperialism, the catch-all phrases and categories of Arab politics since 1967, but an opposition whose be-all and end-all, whose obsession, if you like, is hostility and a sense of responsibility for its own homegrown dictatorship. Now, admittedly, this opposition has not always been easy to deal with. It encompasses diverse traditional and modern elements of Iraqi society. It is fractious and prone to infighting. But then, aren't all democracies, one might ask? Nonetheless, it is remarkable that virtually all of its constituent parts agree on the need for representative democracy, the rule of law, a pluralist system of government, and federalism. Federalism should, therefore, from the viewpoint of this opposition, become a cornerstone of the new Iraqi body politic. Unfortunately, however, neither the Kurdish parliament nor the Iraqi National Congress have yet clarified what they mean by this new idea, nor have they worked out its practical implications with regards to the mechanics of power sharing and resource distribution. But as I said, the driving force behind the idea was the Kurdish experience in Iraq. For Kurds, federalism has become a condition sine qua non for staying inside a new Iraq and not trying to secede from it. Without a federal system of government in which real power is devolved towards the regions, the currently autonomous, predominantly Kurdish north will sooner or later undoubtedly opt for separation. And rightly so. After all that has been done to Kurds in the name of Arabism, no Iraqi should expect otherwise, and certainly no one who calls him or herself a democrat. As a result, there has arisen a purely utilitarian argument for federalism, one derived from a pragmatic calculus of what the balance of power in the immediate aftermath of Saddam's overthrow is going to look like. One must concede federalism, the argument goes among some Iraqis, in the interest, Arab Iraqis, I might add, in the interest of getting rid of Saddam and because the Kurds today are in a position to force it upon us. And we must accept federalism, some Kurds say, not because we really want it, but because the regional situation, namely Turkey, Iran, Syria, etc., does not allow for us to secede and have a separate state in northern Iraq. Now, I do not think that a project as big as restructuring the state of Iraq on a federal basis should be or can be successfully undertaken on the grounds of this kind of utilitarian calculus. No ordinary Iraqi citizen can be expected to opt for federalism on grounds of expediency. If it is to become the founding principle of a new beginning in Iraq, then federalism must derive from a position of principle. So what might that be? To begin with, I like to think of federalism as an extension of the principle of the separation of powers, Only this time, power is being divided as well as separated. And the divisions I'm talking about are those of the regions from one another. Because the regime of Saddam Hussein was never willing to truly relinquish power except under duress, and there's an example in Iraqi history of the 1970 Kurdish autonomy accords, none of its past concessions to the Kurds, as in those March 11th autonomy accords, could ever be taken seriously. They were here one day and gone the next. By contrast, a truly federal system of government is a structurally new system in which power itself is from the outset both separated and divided. From this point of view, federalism is the first step towards a state system resting on the principle that the rights of the part or the minority should never be sacrificed to the will of the majority. The fundamental principle of human rights is that the rights of the part, be that part defined as a single individual in the case of human rights, or if it is defined as a whole collectivity of individuals who happen to speak another language and have their own culture, these rights are inviolable by the state. So federalism is about the rights of those collective parts of the mosaic that is Iraqi society. Question immediately arises and has arisen inside among Iraqis. How should the different parts be defined, the parts of this new federation that I'm talking about? Well, one important approach rests on ethnicity as the basis of the constituent parts. An idea at play in the Iraqi arena at the moment is to have Iraq composed largely of two regions, the first Arab and the second Kurdish. Ethnicity is, according to this point of view, the most fundamental basis for federalism in Iraq. Not surprisingly, a faction of the Kurdish movement in the north are the driving force behind this definition. But non-Kurdish Iraqis and I myself have three problems with this definition, with its formulation. First, it results in ethnicity becoming the basis for making territorial claims and counterclaims, especially with regards to high-profit resources located in one region and not another. The fierce competition over Kirkuk, which you have seen echoes of in the problems with the Turks and the Kurds, is already moving in that direction, with Arab, Kurdish, and Turkoman claims at odds with one another or potentially at odds with one another over this oil-rich city. Second problem is that when a federation is defined as being about two groups, two ethnic groups, then clearly all the other ethnic groups who do not have a share in the federation are being, to one degree or another, discriminated against. Why should an Armenian or a Chaldean or a Turkoman citizen of Iraq have any less rights than an Arab or a Kurd in post-Saddam Iraq? Such discrimination in favor of the two largest ethnic groups is inherently undemocratic. A third problem is that you simply cannot map out a federation geographically on the ground that includes all the different ethnic and religious groups in Iraq. These groupings are not at all territorially concentrated or contiguous. There are Kurds, for example, over 1 million of them in Baghdad, and there are Arabs today in Sulaymaniyah, and there are Turkomans, Armenians, and Chaldeans mixed in with Arabs and Kurds in many locations. Therefore, a federation of many ethnic groups would be no improvement on one made of only two large groups. The logical alternative to ethnicity is genuine territoriality, in which each separate region receives its share of all national resources, including oil revenues, according to the relative size of its population. And that is what is in effect going on in northern Iraq at the moment through the offices of the UN's Oil for Food program. A good argument can be made, it seems to me, for the extension of that UN formula to the whole of Iraq. The future all-Iraqi federation should therefore not be one of different and therefore competing ethnicities, but one of different geographically defined territories within which different ethnicity may form a majority or not. The point is not to diminish or dilute the Kurdishness of a Kurd or the Arabness of an Arab. It is to put a premium on the quality of citizenship for all. Now, the logical corollary of territoriality as a basis for federalism is that the new Iraqi state cannot be thought of in any politically meaningful sense of the word as an Arab entity. Now, this is a new and perhaps dangerous and radical idea for the region, but it follows inexorably from a territorial definition of regions as opposed to an ethnic one. Israel is today, we all know, a Jewish state in which a substantial number of Arab Palestinians, more than a million, have Israeli citizenship, but are not and cannot in principle ever be full-fledged citizens of the State of Israel. The fact that they live in better conditions than their brethren in the West Bank and Gaza, or those in the refugee camps all over the Arab world, is not an argument for second-class citizenship. In principle, because they are in a religious or ethnically defined state, they are somehow or other different, second-class citizens. And one day, it seems to me, the two principles upon which the modern state of Israel was created, democracy and ethnicity, are probably going to come into conflict with one another. But that, of course, is not a problem I'm concerned with. I am concerned with the fact that we should not want such a formula for Iraq. Iraqis deserve to live in an Iraq in which a Kurd or a Chaldean or an Assyrian or a Turkoman, be they male or female, can all in principle be elected to the highest offices of the land. And that means that even though the Arabs form a majority in the country, their majority status should not put them in a position to exclude anyone else from positions of power and influence, as has been the case in the regime led by a party that calls itself the Arab Ba'ath Socialist Party. A democratic Iraq, in other words, has to be an Iraq that by definition exists for all its citizens equally, regardless of race, ethnicity, or religion, and that means a non-Arab Iraq in the sense of the political definition of identity, which, of course, has nothing to do with cultural forms and other forms. Now, this brings me to the third precondition of a genuinely democratic state in Iraq, its relationship to religion. Nothing has so diminished Islam in recent years as its politicization. The quality of Islamic education, Islamic scholarship, and spiritual guidance declined dramatically once the nationalist secular regimes of the post-colonial period came into existence and took over these functions. Nor has the resurgence of political Islam from the 1970s onwards improved matters. The youth of Iran today are turning against the very clergy whom their parents had helped bring to power a generation ago. One hears criticism on the streets of Tehran these days coming from some of the enlightened ulama who themselves played a leading role in the 1979 revolution. Nonetheless, Iran is a success story in comparison with the atrocities that have been perpetrated in the name of Islam and among Muslims in Algeria and until recently in Egypt and the Sudan, or in comparison with what September 11th and the name of Osama bin Laden has done to the image of Muslims throughout the world. The substitution of jihad for worship is the greatest travesty perpetrated upon Islam in modern times. It will take much work and many years by Muslims to undo its pernicious effect. The cumulative effect of these decades of abuse has served ultimately to conceal from Muslims and Arabs in particular the immense and still unexamined terrain of their own great contribution to human civilization. Culture and the life of the spirit have been degraded in Iraq. To guard against the recurrence of such abuse, Iraqis need to invent or discover for themselves a concept of statehood that will give all religions in the country the opportunity to flourish once again. The Babylonian Talmud, for instance, was written just south of Baghdad, and the many branches of the Eastern Church which flourished in Iraq predate Islam and are among the very earliest churches in the history of Christianity. So what, if any, is the relationship which ought to exist between the new Iraqi state and religion? specifically the religion of the overwhelming majority of Iraqis, Islam. Of course, this sort of a question is something which ultimately only the people of Iraq can decide upon in the course of their deliberations over their constitution, for example, during the transitional period. But one way of thinking about these issues, the issues involved, is to pose them in the way that Iraqis in particular have experienced this abuse of their own religion by the regime of Saddam Hussein. And my approach to doing that would be not to ask Iraqis a sort of broad and abstract question like, do you want a secular state or not, but to ask much more concretely something like the following. Do you want your future state to be involved in any way in your religious beliefs, either by way of compelling or persuading you towards a particular belief? Do you want your future state to define individual citizens as members of different religious groups, as happens, for example, in Lebanon? Do you think, in other words, that an individual's religious beliefs are somehow relevant to his or her rights and obligations as a citizen? Do you want your future state to promote, regulate, direct, or otherwise interfere in matters of religion, as the Iraqi state does today through the Ministry of Awqaf, or Religious Affairs? Do you trust your politicians, Iraqi politicians of the future, enough to give them any kind of influence or control over your spiritual life? Finally, do you think Iraqi clerics or ulama, in their religious capacity, of course, and not as private citizens, have the knowledge and experience required to decide upon your political affairs? If the answer that Iraqis give to all of these questions in some future referendum, which will take place during the transitional period, if the answer they give to these questions is no, and if I were to hazard a guess, that is how I think they would vote if you put the question to them in the way I have, then that in effect means that the people of Iraq have chosen to keep matters of politics and matters of religion separate from one another. I'm coming to the last and the end of my talk, and I want to bring up one last important component of the future state, feature of the future state, which I consider to be a extremely desirable safeguard for a genuinely democratic experience in Iraq, and that is the subject of demilitarization. Now, I have left this subject, which is perhaps the most important of all, given the history of Iraq's wars of aggression and buildup of weapons of mass destruction, deliberately to the end. In part, that's maybe because my views on this subject haven't changed much since 1991, when I joined up with more than 400 other Iraqis of every ethnic and religious denomination and from all walks of life to put our names to a document called Charter 91. And the relevant passages from that document relating to this question of demilitarization read as follows. Quote, remember, this had many hundreds of Iraqi signatures of intellectuals and other people abroad, as I said, over 400. Quote, the notion that strength resides in large standing armies and up-to-date weapons of destruction has proved bankrupt. Real strength is always internal, in the creative, cultural, and wealth-producing capabilities of a people. It is found in civil society, not in the army or the state. Armies often threaten democracy. The larger they grow, the more they weaken civil society. This is what happened in Iraq. Therefore, conditional upon international and regional guarantees which secure the territorial integrity of Iraq, a new Iraqi constitution should, Charter 1991 reads, one, abolish conscription and reorganize the army into a professional, small, and purely defensive force which will never be used for internal repression. Two, set an absolute upper limit on expenditure on this force equal to 2% of Iraqi national income. Three, have as its first article, which I'm sure you will all recognize, the following. Quote, aspiring sincerely to an international peace based on justice and order, the Iraqi people forever renounce war as a sovereign right of the nation and the threat or use of force as a means of settling international disputes. The right of belligerency of the Iraqi state will not be recognized. End of quote. That, of course, comes from Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution. I am convinced that if the territorial integrity of the country were to be guaranteed by a set of agreements, for instance, or by an outside power like the United States. The overwhelming majority of Iraqis, certainly its Kurdish and Shiite populations, will vote for such a far-reaching program. Quite understandably, perhaps some parts of the Sunni population will worry about the implications on them of such a loss of an institution that has been important to their role and in the country. Those are legitimate fears and need to be properly addressed. The country will, after all, like post-war Germany, need powerful internal law and order institutions. But also like Germany and Japan after World War II, Iraq's future fundamentally lies in unshackling itself in no uncertain way from the burden of its past and focusing all the creative energies of the country on the reconstruction and cultural renewal. Now, I began by talking about regime change providing a historic opportunity for the United States government and the Iraqi opposition, an opportunity, I said, that is as large as anything that has happened in the Middle East in modern times. And by that, you now know, I mean a federal, non-Arab, demilitarized, secular Iraq. This vision, or something approximating it, is achievable. Moreover, an Iraqi leadership able to work in partnership with the United States to bring such a vision about actually exists. The question that I cannot answer, however, is, will the new resolve that America has discovered in itself post-September 11th rise imaginatively to the level of the opportunity it is about to create in the Middle East? Thank you.